So let's begin by taking the eight or the nine precepts, beginning with the homage to the Buddha. Namo tassa bhagavato Buddham saranam gacchami. Panadipada varamani sikkhapadam samadhiyami.
Panadipada varamani sikkhapadam samadhiyami. Adinadana varamani sikkhapadam samadhiyami. Abrahmacharya varamani
Idam me silam, magapalanyanasa, pachyohotu, pamadena sambadeta. Bow three times, bow three times. Three bows, mindful bows. So today is Wednesday, July 14th, 2004. Just by way of beginning, I'd like to just review what Seato spoke about briefly in his last Dhamma talk. You may remember he spoke of the four kinds of absolute reality: citta, citta-sika, rupa, and nibbana. Three of them being conditioned, one of them being unconditioned. He also explained the need to observe the specific characteristics, samanyalakkhana, the general characteristics, samanyalakkhana, anicca, anatta, and dukkha, as well as the specific characteristics, sabhava lakkhana, of all of those mental and physical phenomena that arise, the three conditioned ones. Now, you know, that's the theory, and if you listen to Seato's Dhamma talks carefully, he'll always give you the theory, he'll give you the Pali verse, he'll translate it, and then he will, if you listen carefully, give you the application of that particular piece of scripture to your individual practices. And so what he then went on to discuss was the need to watch closely any of those three conditioned realities, these three conditioned absolute realities that arise in your particular endeavor as a meditator. So watching them closely, you can begin to see the specific characteristics of the rupa aspects, the apo dhatu, vayo dhatu, tejo dhatu, and patavi dhatu. If you observe all things relating to the body closely, these specific characteristics will become apparent, and in doing so, the concentration will be deep enough so you will see the general characteristics as well, anicca, anatta, and dukkha. You'll experience it. Similarly, any mental state that arises, each state, anger, fear, doubt, love, lust, whatever, has their particular specific characteristics which you can become aware of. And once you note that and see it, then the other three general characteristics become pretty apparent. And that's what's needed, you know, the attention to this detail to make progress in this. So that's always been the pattern of Seato's Dhamma talks. And so I just wanted to briefly review his last one so we can segue into this one, just to give you a little catch-up. Tonight I'm going to talk about two topics. One is general, and the other is a more specific topic appropriate and practical for your daily practice today and in future. I hope to, you know, of course, inspire those that need to amp their effort up a little to do so, to encourage the ones that are already making good effort to continue, and to remind every one of you that this practice really has a foundation of patience, persistence, and perseverance. If you are patient with yourself and persevere persistently throughout this practice, you can really make good results. Now, the patience and perseverance arise because, you know, you're not always going to be perfectly noting every phenomena that arises and passes away. And given our North American neuroses for perfection, we sometimes sink into depressions or despair or doubt simply because we didn't do it right, you know. Bad yogi. Well, the truth of the matter is there's no bad yogis. Because even if you miss something, if you find yourself dreaming for half an hour, the moment you realize you're dreaming, you note it and you see the dream disappear, you've had an insight, a little tiny insight into impermanence. Okay? Now, you're right, you cost yourself half an hour of concentration, but so what? Who cares? You know, I mean, everyone ultimately cares, but don't beat yourself up about it, because this is, you're fighting the weight of a lifetime of collecting these bad habits. You know, a few weeks can do a lot of undoing of them, but, you know, it's not going to happen every time. So just, again, lighten up, be patient, but be persistent. Don't give up. Get back on the horse, get riding again. The general topic tonight deals with the four classes of beings that the Buddha spoke of during his time regarding the attainment of Nibbana in this sasana. They are the Ugatitanu, Vipacitanu, Neya, and Padaparama. Now, each of these four classes of individuals had or has more or less flexibility to attain Nibbana. The Ugatitanus, when they heard a few words of the Dhamma spoken by the Omniscient One, immediately attained a Nibbana, enlightenment. Their paramis were so well developed that all they needed to hear was a few words, and bingo. The Thais have a very interesting analogy. They call this the analogy of the four lotus. The first lotus, the Ugatitanu, is a lotus that has poked its way up in the water and is almost blooming and only needs a few rays of sunlight of the Dhamma to blossom fully into a fully realized lotus. Or, of course, the analogy is a fully enlightened being. The second, Vipacitanu, needed to hear the full discourse. The full discourse had to be absorbed, and then the realization of enlightenment would occur. And the Thai analogy is a lotus blossom that has barely broached or breached the water and needs to have a full dose of sunlight to grow and blossom into a fully enlightened, fully mature lotus. Now, all of you have been listening to the Dhamma for about 12 days. Any lights gone off? Any arahats here? No? No. Oh, rats. Oh, shoot. Darn it. Well, I guess that leaves Neya and Padaparamas in this room now. Okay, so let's talk about them. Fact is, truth is, according to Seato and Lady Seato and a couple of other Seatos I've talked about, there are in fact no Ugatitanus, Vipacitanus in this realm at this time, in this earth realm. So the myth of having an acorn touch your head and you become enlightened ain't there at this particular time. There are a world full of Neyas and Padaparamas. That's it. Now, the Neyas are a particular class of individuals who need to hear the discourse, whether it's short or long, but they also need to do what you're doing. They need to practice for anywhere from 7 days to 60 years. That's and that's not very much time cosmologically, really, is it? It's a blink, really. We'd prefer to be closer to the 7 days than 60 years, I know, but I can't control your parami, your kilesa, your dhamma, your kama. I can't help that. But the key here is practicing is most important, and a neya has the opportunity in this existence, based on the maturity of the parami, to actually make progress, to attain one of the Aryan stages, one of the noble stages. It's doable, okay? And, you know, I can't tell who is who. No one can, really. It's important for these beings to practice particularly hard, because they may just accumulate enough merit to make it to the Deva realms and possibly miss this sasana, because devas live millions of years, but that's all theoretical. The neya should really strive to attain at least sotapanna, stream entry. And that ensures no rebirths in the lower realms. You understand this, I think. Sotapanna, Sagadami, Anagami, Arahat, stream enter, most seven lives in the earth realm or higher. The kilesas of doubt and belief in rites and rituals, and the triple gems faith is very strong, so their mind is permanently changed, the consciousness never to end up or take birth in a lower realm. Okay, Sagadamis, of course, will only be back one more time, once returners. They've gotten rid of ill will and anger to a certain extent. Anagamis, never coming back, always in the higher deva realms to attain enlightenment. And, of course, arahats finally attaining enlightenment in this realm or another one. But the key to attaining stream entry is you're in the stream. It's impossible for you at some time in the future not to attain awakening. Okay, it's the stream enter is an appropriate analogy. You're in the current. You're in the mix. There's just no stopping, and it depends on the whole realm, mix of your particular kilesa, dharma, karma, as to how many lifetimes you take to attain the higher stages. Now, the Padaparamas, no matter what they do in this life, they won't go anywhere. They won't, let's put it this way, they won't attain Nibbana in this lifetime. But does that mean they're out of the game? No. They're still in, because any practice they engage in this particular lifetime will feather the next existence's life so that they can then attain in the next lifetime as a human. So it's very important for Padaparamas who, for a variety of reasons, you know, particularly stubborn mind, disability, dullness, a bad set of kilesas, a bad set of karma coming to bear in this lifetime. Who knows? I can't tell you. But they just haven't got the faculties needed or the diligence needed to push through this time. But if they do engage in diligent practice, the benefits, the wholesome, the impulsion, the karma from that practice will manifest in another near present existence. Okay, so it's very important to practice. And why is that? Okay, well, I'll give you some other information. In the Visuddhimagga, under this, some of the commentaries or sub-commentaries, there's a statement that this sasana, now the Buddha didn't say this, but it's in the commentaries, that this sasana will last only 5,000 years. Okay, we're halfway through it, in other words. Now, there's two choices. You know, the commentaries are either right or they're wrong. Okay, if they're right, do the math. But 2,500 years left approximately leaves you with, say, 70 years, a lifetime. What's that? 30 human lives, maybe, if you're lucky. If you are fortunate enough to keep resuming in this realm, good. You got 35 human lives until this sasana disappears and they say such dramatic things as the word Dhamma will be understood nowhere in the earthly realms. You could shout it down any street and no one will understand it. It's going to be that bereft of the teachings of the Buddha if this commentary is correct. Okay, now 35 lifetimes as a human may seem doable, but again, in this particular dance, there's no guarantees. We're all very lucky. We wouldn't be sitting in a meditation hall in a fairly prosperous country, in a fairly prosperous continent, sort of unaffected too much by the turmoils of the various wars going on if our karma wasn't good now. Like this resulting, I'm looking at a bunch of somewhat karmically lucky people, in just my humble opinion, though. But there's no guarantee that something else won't come up and drag you down, or there's no guarantee that the mind that is particularly chaotic won't become more chaotic as life progresses or as the next set of existences arises, and suddenly you're breaking precepts, little ones, little tiny ones, and then gradually larger ones, and then larger ones, and then larger ones, and then suddenly you're stuck in the lower realms as a snake or a spider, making your living eating other things, committing a major breach of the precepts, a major, you don't get away with it just because you're a spider and you eat flies for a living. You're still killing daily or weekly or whenever a fly happens to wander into your web. And that creates even more negative karma, more darker impulsions, which drag you down and down and down. So there are no guarantees, really, that you're going to continue to have the fortunate existences that you enjoy now. And there's even no guarantee that this existence will continue to be blessed or lucky or fortunate. We all know that. That's not news to anyone, is it? No. Okay? That was a sort of a lighthearted attempt to raise the... I don't want to be too heavy here, but... So I'm trying to lighten it up again. But that's the fact, okay? So therefore, it behooves you to practice diligently to at least attain what is called in the scriptures, according to some writing by a Burmese Sayadaw, Lady Sayadaw, Tula Sotapanna, which is little Sotapanna. Little Sotapannas have attained the first two stages of jnana, insight into the nama-rupa, okay, and insight into conditionality. If you attain those two jnana, then your existence is almost identical to a sotapanna in that you're guaranteed at least one more existence in the human realms, okay? The reason for that is the first two jnana actually begin to introduce you to the understanding of anatta and the understanding of cause and effect. So as long as the Tula Sotapannas keep practicing and keep their precepts and keep strong, they will in fact be almost certain of a rebirth in another lifetime in the human realms, which is the best place to do the work, because here there's not too much suffering or too much pleasure. Lower realms, a lot of dukkha. In the lower animal realms, as we observe as humans, you're either lunch or looking for it. Okay, in the deva realms, I've never been there in this lifetime, but according to what I understand, there's a lot of pleasure. It's party time. And long lifetimes. So there's no incentive in either of those two proximate realms to practice. Here we have enough dukkha that it kind of pushes us, and not enough sukha that we get lost in bliss for countless centuries. So that's why it behooves us to practice quite diligently. Now, if the commentary is wrong, okay, and the sasana will go on for X number of years longer or somewhat indefinitely, do you still want to keep coming back and going through this stuff again with the same baggage and the same angst and the same fears and doubt and decay and death? And I mean, really? I don't want to. And I think all of you wouldn't be here if you really wanted to either. You're here for some reason. So either way, it's kind of a bet, either this commentary is completely right, it isn't the Buddha's words exactly, so, or it's not, and there's still incentive to practice diligently. There's still incentive. Now, wherever you are, or whatever your position in this whole grand scheme of things. You have to realize one thing. Meditation is the most wholesome, refined action a human can engage in. It is nothing more refined or elegant or beneficial to you and the rest of your fellow humans and the rest of probably the beings in the universe. There's no other activity that you can engage in that is more refined, more beneficial than this very practice of meditation. Okay? The main reason for that, well, I mean, there's many, but there's one really good one, is that it creates a very wholesome impulsion, a very wholesome direction, a very wholesome state of mind, which cannot help but benefit you in this life or in any, maybe many future lives. So no matter, that's the perspective I want to give the ones that are feeling depressed about not noting thinking so well today. The very act of being here, you know, with whatever skill level you bring to this, and it's going to get better and better because, as Seattle says, practice makes perfect. It's still a good thing, a very good thing, a darn good thing. It has nothing but possible benefits to you. Okay? The karma from it, the karma that arises from this activity, proximately and distantly, is superb. Okay? So that is the reason, regardless of whether you're a Neya or a Padaparama, to engage in this practice. And the stages of awakening that will arise for you, given diligent effort from 7 days to 60 years, is doable. You know, these jnana, even as you're moving up the ladder of the jnana, from the first to second, third, fourth, right up to the 13th, just prior to the attainment of Magapala jnana, these jnana affect you. They affect this life dramatically. They give you an understanding of the way things are experiential understanding, not a verbal, not an oral, not an analytic, not a conceptual understanding, but an experiential understanding of the way things are that impacts you magnificently, even if you don't enter stream. So, you know, that's the reason to practice, because there are benefits even as you move along and through and up and according to the paths of the Visuddhimagga, the paths to purification. The very least that happens from this, the worst thing that happens in meditation is you have a very good stress release mechanism, okay? If all it is a stress release mechanism for you that you do daily and doesn't allow it to build up, that's the worst thing that happens. That's not too bad. But that is kind of like very cheap. That's easy. You know, that's easy. Many other things are magnificently possible with this practice. So, that's a broad reason to practice. You know, that's the broad stroke reasons to practice, because it provides benefits to you, all beings around you. Now, more specifically, yogis always face challenges. Okay, it's not easy. You know, it seems very easy. You just sit and watch your breath, or your thinking, or your lifting, or your pushing, or your dropping, or your eating, or your hearing. It's so, what could be simpler? You know, like it's, but it is one of the hardest easy things you'll do. It's like it's so simple, except for a few things that seem to get in the way. These are challenges that we'll talk about a little bit today. Four, thinking, the niwarana, the sleepiness and the hindrances, aversion to slowing down, and your best friend, pain. These are four challenges that you have to meet head on as yogis. I'm going to deal with two of them, one in sort of brief length and one a little longer. Thinking is the first one, and it is the most important thing to note in this practice. Now, I think we've been over this enough. Thinking is not a problem for a yogi. Getting lost in thoughts is. Becoming a dreamer, not a meditator, is fatal for a few minutes. Noting thinking must be absolutely top priority. The reason is, if you don't note thinking, you start to enjoy the movies that are going on in your head, or the commentary, or whatever. They tend to chain link. They tend to replicate like weeds. And lo and behold, sudden other mind states that are even more difficult to deal with arise, ending in the beautiful one of sloth and torpor or restlessness, or doubt. Mm-hmm. So thinking leads to at least three or four of the hindrances that I'll mention in a while. Unnoted thinking leads to that. Noted thinking leads to realization of the impermanence of the citta nupassana, of the citta, of the thought processes, of the citta-seka. Okay, noted thinking brings you awareness that this is impermanent. It's not me because it's vanishing. Descartes was wrong. I don't think, and therefore I am. He was wrong. You see that. You are not your thoughts. Unless you note them. If you note them, you are not your thoughts. If you don't note them, you'll believe it. It'll create a whole fantasy world for you, which will reinforce the belief in self. It'll give the illusion of fun, pleasure, and it'll seem pleasant. And as far as being impermanent, it's up to you. That's the kind of dicey one. But it certainly reinforces the belief in self. However, noted thinking does not. You can see the true nature of it. You can see you are not your thoughts. They are a real pain, annoyance at best, 95% of them. And they're not permanent. They're not permanent. So you have to be very vigilant with thinking, because it's the slippery part of the sense door. It's the slipperiest of all sense doors. The second, the five hindrances, which are the kamachanda, the desire, sensual desire, ill will, anger, restlessness and remorse, sloth and torpor, sleepiness and doubt, are challenges. They are. But as I said, if you note thinking, three of them are eliminated right away. The first one, sense desire, which sometimes is interpreted as, lust, real indulgent kind of sensuality. Well, meditators don't do that, okay, because we've taken nine precepts, which kind of exclude a lot of the sensuality that we humans like to indulge in. But nonetheless, the sense desires are still very prevalent and very subtle and very seductive. The sense desires that this kamachanda particularly refers to is the desire to just take a look and see what's happening over there. Oh, isn't that nice? It's a bird. And it's a beautiful bird. And I remember when I was a kid, there was a flock of birds, and they were beautiful too. And that's when we went to the fair, and that's when I won a teddy bear. And what am I doing here? Why am I here? I should be with the bird. It just goes and goes. Endless linking. So the sense doors are, unless guarded, will lead you to a story. Okay? Again, more thinking. noted anywhere along the way of this continuum. There's a flutter over there. Desire, desire, desire. The desire goes, continues, you continue moving on. Flutter over there. Desire, but it doesn't work. You're looking, you see the bird, you note seeing, 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 you note turning, 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 and you continue. Or flutter, look, start thinking, note thinking, 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 seeing, 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 turning, 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 and you're still in the game. You're still meditating. But if you don't note any one of those, you don't break it at any time, you're into another movie, maybe. Okay, and that's only seeing, hearing, tasting, smelling, touching, not so much touching, but, and our good old friend thinking. Any one of those sense doors, they look a lot more fun than sitting in a meditation hall in Barre, Massachusetts. They seem to have more appeal until you get lost in them, and then until you're restless, and then, geez, it's hard here. You see, just break the chain anywhere along the way, and you're still a meditator. Anywhere. Okay? The longer you wait, the thicker the soup gets, though. The stickier the quicksand. You know? The more the flypaper hangs on to you, the Velcro sticks. Sooner is better. Okay? With the sense desires. Restless and remorse or ill will won't really arise if you note thinking as well. The yogi who butts in front of you and takes the last mango may make you angry. Yes. But then you're going to have to note that. And just note ill will, ill anger, 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 you know, desire, frustration, frustration. And then watch it and then take the watermelon instead and enjoy the watermelon and note that. But pretty well the rest of them are taken care of if you note your thinking process quickly, okay? Sleepiness especially can be noted in that way. I've talked to many of you about how to overcome sleepiness, so I'm not going to spend much more time. Now here's one. The third one, slowing down. Slowing down. I ate lunch with some of you folks today. I was over in the corner with the Venerable Ubuddha Rakita. And when I wasn't eating slowly, I watched some of you. And I saw that there were a few that are still eating very quickly. Okay, very, very quickly. Now, eating is especially a good place to slow down. Okay, eating is a great place to slow down. You know, and there should be no reason to slow down in eating, except for, I'll give you a few right now. The habitually impatient mind, a proud mind, a stubborn mind, an anxious mind, or a greedy mind will not let you slow down when you're eating. Okay? You just won't do it. You haven't got time, you got to get the food in you, got to get your gullet filled, got to get back to the room, and got to do something besides eat slowly. Right. Okay, guess what's happening when you're not eating slowly? I heard a lot of hissing sounds, and I was sad because it was concentration leaking and running across the floor out into the gutter. I heard it hissing away as people were gobbling their food down. This mind that, you know, prevents you from slowing down will keep you in a level of suffering, you know, returning again and again to the endless patterns, just unhappy patterns in this life and other lives. That mind that, creates the resentment or the story as why not to slow down eating is a major lodestone that can be examined by slowing down when you eat. Because eating is particularly interesting. It's dead important. We have to eat or we'll die in a little while. But around this particularly very important process, there's a whole series of, you know, greed, gluttony, sensuality, addiction, fear if you're afraid of eating too much, and angst if you don't eat enough. All of these things play. And to overcome these fears, guess what we do? We gobble, gobble, gobble. And that seems to cover off the feelings of, ooh. You know, by stuffing food in our mouth, we cover up this feeling of angst. By slowing down, though, you can see these mind states and see their true natures, not to mention the slow movements that arise when you're reaching and pushing, and that the observation of chewing mindfully. Because if you leave this mind unchecked, you know, with no intervention, nothing's going to change. You know, nothing's going to change. And, you know, Seattle Ujjanika has been teaching for 45 years, and Mahasi, his teacher, for about 50. And, you know, they've sat with, told thousands, every one of the thousands of yogis they've met to slow down. And they've seen amazing results. So they didn't come here, Seattle didn't come here to torture you by telling you to slow down or to browbeat you. That wasn't the purpose. It was to help you, because it does work. You know, a yogi I talked to recently said, you know, give yourself the gift. The best gift you can in this practice is to slow down, because the practice becomes a first-class practice when you slow down and note throughout the day. It's the best gift you can give yourself. Now, you know, again, I'll just get hypothetical here. You've all come, you're all here for X number of more days. There's no appointments, no appointment calendars. What else have you got to do? You know, in the next 10 days or 20 days, when you go home, you'll be able to go as quick as you want for the rest of your life. This is maybe the only opportunity this year that you'll have a chance to test what we're saying and see if it actually does give you a practice that is, you know, worthy, first class. There's nothing else to do here. It's not fatal. No one died from slowing down to our experience. So why not? Now again, do it at your pace. Realize that when you've walked quickly for 20 or 30 feet, there's leaking concentration behind you. But, you know, give yourself that gift. It truly is a gift. And, I can speak from my own experience. My experience torqued upward when I finally believed, Seattle, that slowing down was valid. And I put it to my old, you know, I'm from Missouri, show me, and I tried it. And yes, the practice really shot upwards. And many other yogis, I could give you anecdotal, you know, discussions about it. So, you know, the good news of this practice is it took, you know, at least decades to build up the bad habits that are preventing us from slowing down. But in a very short few days or a few weeks or a few months even, you can severely weaken these tendencies that you've developed, these negative mental states, if not dissolve some of them completely. So, I mean, it's amazing technology that within a few weeks or a few days or a few months, you can dramatically, with good effort and continuous mindfulness and the ensuing deep concentration, you know, severely loosen these 10 kilesas hold on you. I mean, I see it all the time with yogis. So, you know, dive in the pool. Dive in the slow pool. See what happens. Then I won't have to tell you to slow down anymore. Now the other challenge I want to talk to you about is one of my favorite. It's the pain. It's painful sensations. It's the one that Seattle in many of his books speaks of as a meditator's best friend. A meditator's best friend because It is the key, the doorway, the key to the doorway of Nibbana. And it's a challenge, though, because, you know, we avoid pain fastidiously in our lives. It's one of the things we dive away from. Either we move, shift, take a pill, have a drink, have a shower, whatever. It's one of the major challenges in this practice. But it's one that does provide you with deep concentration. Now, I'd like to tell you a couple stories, my own story about pain, just so you'll hear it. I went to study with Seattle, meditate with Seattle in 1994. I took a sabbatical, and I practiced with him in Thailand for 3 weeks. And again, that's when my practice began zooming, and I asked him if I could come to Chen Mie Yekta to continue practice. He said, sure, come during Rain's retreat. And I said, could I become a monk? I've always thought about it. He said, yeah, you can be a yogi monk. I thought, great. So I ended up in the rainy season in Burma practicing, and there was a bit of trepidation, but there was a lot of excitement because I had at least 3 months of practice and possibly 4 or 5 months to practice with Seattle, who I was deeply respectful of. So it was exciting to have sort of the luxury of that much time. And in the first week or two, it was going swimmingly. It was just like floating on a cloud, and I'd report that to Seattle. I'd say, my practice is going beautifully. I'm floating around like I'm on up in one of those clouds. I'm feeling happy and peaceful, and everything is just amazing. And Seattle, you know, gave me some instructions, and off I went. One day, I started to notice that there was some, you know, growing kind of discomfort, tightness, squeezing, heat was there, and I thought, okay, pain is coming. Pain is coming, but I have a good strategy to get rid of it. So when I went to Seattle, I reported. He said, your progress, who wants a Rikita? I said, well, I'm starting to feel pain, Seattle, and it's getting a little severe. But I have a time-tested way of overcoming it. And he said, what's that? Who wants a Rikita? I said, I simply move my legs, and it vanishes instantly. And then I'm back in my cloud again, floating. He looked at me, and he smiled. And he blinked his eyes, and he said, no, wants a Rikita. That's not how you deal with pain. I said, what do you do? He said, you must stay still and note it and observe it patiently. I said, I can do that. Yep, sure, I'll do that. Well, little did I know, of course, the more you note the pain, the deeper your concentration becomes and the more severe the pain becomes. And my pain was you could cook an egg by it. 22 minutes in, it started, and that was it. And it was nasty. It morphed into electric eels crawling up and down my legs. Someone was drilling a sledgehammer into my knee. There was a feeling of bubbling, hot, molten metal bubbling, popping and popping, burning me, white hot heat. Someone had my leg in a vice and was twisting it, and it was going to crack, I was sure. That was 22 minutes in until I gave up. So I go and I'd say, Seattle, your progress, who wants a Rikita? Okay, Seattle, I'm feeling pain. I'm doing my best to note it, but it is difficult. He said, good. Good, he said. It's your best friend. I said, what? He said, yes, pain is your best friend. I didn't believe him, but back I went. I mean, to make a long story short, I secretly was kind of, I made a resolution after the second or third interview with Seattle where he kept encouraging me. I said, look, I got 5 months here, and frankly, I've been facing pain every retreat, and I'm getting tired of shuffling around. all, you know, every retreat. So I said, look, I don't care. I'm going to watch this darn stuff and just see what happens. And frankly, if I die from the pain, I don't care. Because, you know, dying in a monastery is not a bad place to go. The monks are around you. They'll chant. I thought, if this was it, you know, if this really is the way I'm going to go in 1994, that's okay. No problem. I kind of knew, though, that I wasn't going to die, because every time I got up, 3 steps later, it was gone. You know, the searing heat, the burning, bubbling lava was just, it wasn't there anymore. So I had a feeling I wasn't really going to die from it. But I wasn't going to give up either. So I pressed on and on and on. Seattle would say, your progress, who wants to repeat it? More pain. And then he gave me strategies to watch it, the way to approach it with a microscopic view and backing off when appropriate and staying mindful when I finished and not to get discouraged. It was a very important gate. Please stay with it. Every arahat, every yogi who's been down this path has faced the very thing you're facing, who wants a rakita. Please don't give up. Please stay with it. Okay, I thought, I will. But, you know, it didn't lessen. As a matter of fact, one day it got so severe that I fainted. I keeled right over on the stage, legs in the air, and guess what? The monks did come to me. And they did say, are you okay, Wansarikita? Oh, yeah, I'm fine, up I get. So I knew they'd be there if I died, because they were there when I fainted. Anyway, one thing led to another. A number of days later, I began to just sit quietly with the pain, and suddenly, you know, the pain wasn't mine. It was just intense. It was intense, but it wasn't mine. I was watching it, and it was like a flower opening and closing and opening and closing. There was petals of a leaf just opening, and I just kept going in and in. And it eventually just exploded. Just boom, like that, fireworks. Following that, as difficult and as harsh the pain had been, I never felt a place more serene, more peaceful, more tranquil than right after that explosion. There was no thoughts. There was a blue aura, a nice blue light flickering. There was just the keen awareness, the keen focus. And I thought, this is it. I've done it. Hooray. So I couldn't wait for the interview next day. I even went home that night and finished. I put clean robes on the next day, had a shower, checked my hair out of a bad habit I'd had. It wasn't there, of course. Walked into Seattle, almost strutting like a peacock. Your progress, Uwansarikita. Seattle, I have to tell you what happened. It was the most sublime state I've ever been in, the most peace I've ever felt, the most beauty I've ever experienced, the most calm, serene area I've ever been. Oh, he said. I told him the story. He looked at me. He smiled, blinked his eyes a couple of times, and said, did you note it? I said, Seattle, you don't note Nibbana. Come on. By this time, he's laughing, chuckling, as you may have seen him do. He says, no. Who wants it? That is not Nibbana. That is not the path. You must note this very, very diligently and very carefully. Because this is, in fact, the vipassanubhikkhulesa, the corruptions. This is a false nibbana. Please note it next time. Which I did. And it went away, and then I continued on my merry way down the path, having discovered what was path and not path, by the direction of Seattle. So that's a little story about pain, and the divergent, of course, is you can see clearly by this. I fell face first, headlong into the corruptions, the vipassanupakilesa. I thoroughly convinced myself that I had become an enlightened being in a very short time, and was very proud of myself. Yes. So I'll go through the corruptions, because a few of you have been mentioning them in your various discourses. Nine of them are actually quite helpful. It's the tenth one that triggers it. So, well, eight of them anyway. The first one, many of you have mentioned seeing light, illumination. It's often mistaken for Dhamma perception or some wonderful thing. It's nothing. It just arises as a result of a very clear mind. The jnana that are arising, the rapid noting, the delight in the focus of the mind. Piti can arise. Pasadi can arise. Sukha, blissful happiness, can arise. Faith becomes very strong. Effort is also balanced. Bhagaha is very balanced. Upatana, sharp sati, the mind is very sharp. Samadhi is very deep. Upeka, although slightly imperfect, is there. Eight of those are actually very helpful, and four of them are factors of enlightenment. Okay? But they're not the problem. The tenth one is, which is the subtle or gross attachment, pride, or false view of each one of those things. Nikanti, it's called in Pali. That's the killer. The rest of them are okay, but it's that clinging, craving, pride, diti, that allows you to even subtly enjoy this little, this little light is so nice, I'll just watch it for a while. Or this calm, I've never felt it, it's beautiful. Let's take a break, just relax. That is the fatal error. That is why they're corruptions. Now, none of them in their own right is particularly wrong. In fact, it's very much like taking a trip to Boston. Or let's say we're going to New York. That's our goal, New York. Nibbana, New York, Nibbana, New York. We're on our way. It's like coming to the first signpost that directs you to New York, getting out of the car and hugging it. You're hugging the signpost along the way. Sorry, get back in your car, get going again. You're on the right road, but this ain't it. Now, yours truly fell face first into that trap. I thought it was. I got out of the car and I started to dance with the signposts. I was that happy to have met them. Anyway, that's a little tangent, just so any of you who know, do not... Just be aware of even the subtlest attachment to any one of those corruptions I just described. Otherwise, you're going to get caught in a little whirlpool at the side of the road and just be there for a while. And actually lose concentration. But I digress. Let's get back to pain, okay? As I said earlier, pain is one of those things in life that we avoid almost too scrupulously. It's part of the dukkha of being human, and it's something that we try to avoid. Unfortunately, there's no way around it. You cannot avoid it. You can spend your meditation life like I did, moving legs to avoid it, but nothing's going to happen. That's the end of the practice. So the only way is to go through it and see it in its true nature, because the dukkha of pain has the characteristic of anicca. It's a gate, it's impermanent. You have to experience its impermanence. Now, the reason it's a meditator's best friend, I found out, and I hope many of you enjoy this awareness later or now, is it really deepens the concentration. There's no question about concentration being deep when the pain's there. There's no sleepiness. Not very much thinking or distraction when pain and you, it's just you, the mind, and pain. And the benefit of watching pain is that you will begin to see it in its true nature if you're patient with it. And this awareness of pain in its true nature will be with you for the rest of this, will profoundly affect you in this lifetime. So pain is very important to observe. And I'd like to give you a number of tips that, you know, I may have given them to you already, but I'll just review them. Treat the pain when it arises as an investigation, not a battle. Okay? Cultivate the investigative quality around it. You know, I mean, again, you're going to have the rest of your year to investigate pain or to avoid pain. Here is where you get to see it very clearly. Okay? So don't run from it. See pain, watch it from a variety of proximities, like a three-powered microscope. Get right in and watch the very intense points of pain. Go right inside, pull back to medium and see it arising and passing away. And if it gets particularly difficult, back right off and see it from a fair distance. Okay? That's fine. Another thing that's very important, when pain arises in normal life, there's one of three mental states that almost laminates itself immediately to the pain: fear, anger, or aversion. And it's so tight in daily life, we can't see the difference, so we move, we take a pill, we take a drink, we go for a shower, we do whatever it takes to get rid of this pain. Okay? In vipassana practice, where you're slowing down and able to see things very clearly, if you find the pain becoming unbearable, if possible, go and look at what the mental state around this unbearability is. Is it fear? Is it anger? Is it aversion? And then once you've seen that, isolate it, note it attentively until it disappears, and then return to what the pain is. 99 times out of 100, you're going to see the pain as just heat, pressure, or vibration. It might be intense heat, it might be intense vibration, or intense pressure, but it won't be unbearable anymore for a lot of the time. Also, and that's a very important aspect, then you begin to see the separation of nama-rupa, the mental state that dissolves and the physical state of pain arising and passing away. The fourth thing, just take a rest. Take a break. Go to the rising and falling and leave the pain over there. Just let it be. Take a break, take a rest. It's hard. It is hard work watching pain, there's no question. So if you need to take a rest, just pull back and rising and falling, okay? As Seattle said to me many, many times, and I'll say it to you as well, be patient, be persistent, don't give up. It really does have a beneficial effect to watch pain. Realize that any time you spend observing pain is more than you've spent to date. So even 5 minutes of watching pain is five more minutes of insight or attempted insight into pain. So, you know, you take umbrage in the fact that you're watching pain for as long as you can, and it may be 5, 10, 15 minutes, an hour and a half, or 90 minutes. But just know that whatever happens, you're taking steps that are deepening your concentration and progressing your practice. Now, guaranteed, if you watch 5 or 10 or 2 minutes of pain or 30 minutes or 40 minutes of pain, your concentration is going to take a quantum leap upward or an exponential. It's going to dip dramatically. It's going to deepen dramatically. Okay? So, when you're fortunate enough to enjoy or to watch the pain to the extent that you can, don't waste the concentration that you've gained by popping your eyes open and hopping up and, you know, staggering out of the meditation hall. Don't disperse the benefit that you will have enjoyed by even a few minutes of noting pain. When the pain becomes absolutely unbearable, or it's time to go, or finished, pipa-bi in Burmese, over, wait a few minutes, keep your eyes closed, slowly, slowly rise, rising, rising, noting all the actions and movements that take you from sitting position to standing position with your eyes closed. Then note the standing posture, noting what's happening with the body as the pain dissipates. This will allow you to maintain the continuity of concentration that you've hard won by sitting through the pain. I mean, it's one of the benefits. Don't throw it away by popping up like a jack-in-the-box from the sit just because the pain was too intense. Relatively speaking, jack-in-the-box. I mean, you guys never pop up, but too quickly to note what's happening. That's a wonderful strategy to maintain the continuity from sitting to walking without dissipating that hard-won pain concentration. Similarly, when you come back to sit from a well-concentrated walk, close your eyes as you approach the sitting cushion when you know exactly where you're going to put your bum. Just mindfully get down and sit. I guess to end this Dhamma talk, I'd like to tell you a story about the best answer as to why we meditate that I ever, you know, experienced or heard from a little old lady in Thailand, an 83-year-old yogi in Thailand. And she was an elegant, probably 4 foot nothing, 5 foot, maybe 4 foot 10 lady whose elegance and demeanor was from another era. Very distinguished, perfect little bouffant hairdo, very keen to meditate, with one proviso she gave me. She said, I'm 83, and I'm only going to sit for half an hour, and I'm only going to walk for half an hour. I said, okay, no problem. You're 83, but just for fun, and maybe to push yourself a little bit, why don't you walk 45 minutes and sit 45 minutes and see what happens? You got nothing else to do. If it doesn't work, we'll do something else. She said, okay. Off she went. The next day was interview time. I said, how was your walking practice? She said, it was great, fabulous. Thai words to those effect, really. She spoke Thai and I spoke English. And I said, why? She said, because when I was walking very slowly and noting everything you told me to note, Bhante, and suddenly it was as if someone else's feet were walking. They weren't mine. It was like I was watching my feet walk. And I said, that's good. That's the first jnana. That's excellent. Very good. That's a very good insight. And I explained anatta jnana and everything like that. And she was beaming. So I said, how was your sitting? She said, it was good. Very good. It was like floating on a cloud. Very happy, very peaceful. And then she said, and then this very severe pain came. The most severe I'd ever felt in my life. And, you know, having been there, I thought her next sentence was going to be, and then I got up and I walked. And she said, no, that's not what I did. I sat there and watched the pain, and the same thing happened. It was like the pain was in a valley, and I was on a hill watching it. And I said, good. The same insight in different format. Excellent. Well done. And she said it got even better because then I could see the pain coming and going, arising and disappearing very clearly, coming and going. As severe as it was, I could see it very clearly. I said, good experience. Good experience. Her next statement was when my jaw hit the ground, though. She said, but Bhante, I decided to keep watching it. She said, because I am 83. And I'm not going to live very much longer. And I thought that the pain of death could be no worse than this very severe pain that I am experiencing here. No worse. So I thought, I reflected in my mind, it would be good to become comfortable with this pain now, so that when my final few minutes on earth and the pain of death is racking me, I'll be able to die with a peaceful, focused, unconfused, unafraid mind. My jaw was on the ground. I said, bingo. She knew what I meant. She laughed. Bingo, because they play it in Thailand sometimes. I said, that's the reason you meditate, yes. So that you'll die with an unconfused, peaceful, and focused mind. And yes, that's the reason you do indeed note pain. Because yes, it won't surprise you. You get a dry run at it here. If you don't have it if you don't get this dry run when pain comes, you're going to be clinging, grabbing, afraid, struggling, and you won't have any strength left, because that's what death is about. You're extinguishing. Your mind and body processes are extinguishing. It's like trying to cram for an exam. It's too late. Too late at that time. She was right. I told Seattle, and he said, yes, that's exactly correct, of course. The next day I said to her, I said, may I have your permission for something? And she said, what? I said, I would like to use your story as a Dhamma talk with your permission. Well, she turned red, beet red. She giggled and she said, well, Bhante, if you think it'll help anyone, yes, you may. I thought, good. So the lady understands why we meditate, and that's why we do meditate, and that's why we engage in the watching of pain, so that we can see its true nature, so that when it comes at any other time, our minds will automatically become noting rather than fearful. So that's the best answer that I've ever come up with, demonstrated by this 83-year-old Thai lady, as to why we meditate and why to watch pain. So, may all of you rightly practice, rightly understand the practice of meditation as expounded by and taught by the Venerable Mahasi Seattle, the Venerable Seattle Ujjanika. May you rightly understand its practice. May you make progress and avoid the tricks and traps along the way. May this progress grow and blossom for you. May it become the basis for your attainment of Nibbana. May each and every one of you attain this goal.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.